Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people here in Mendocino County, California. I am the show's producer, Dan Roberts. This month's show is a recording from a public presentation called Opioids and Youth. This past January, Avenues to Wellness in Willits hosted Andrew Thomas, a young adult recovering from opioid addiction, Dr. Andrea McCulloch, an emergency room physician, Buffy Wright Barassa, an opioid specialist at Public Health, and Auralee Clivis, program manager at Mendocino County Youth Project. The speakers offered support, tools, prevention strategies, and recovery options to families and professionals working with youth. We will begin with Mary Ann Cox from Adventist Health Howard Memorial Hospital introducing Andrew.
I just want to take a moment to really recognize and honor Andrew. Andrew is our keynote speaker, and he's going to be sharing his story. But Andrew is also a friend of mine, and I met Andrew. I'm a health coach, and I met Andrew when he was actually deciding to come off of Suboxone, and I didn't even know what that was. Like, that was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I was working with Andrew just around diet and lifestyle, but I got to know him, and he's a really special and exceptional person. And I also got to witness someone who was tapering himself off of Suboxone with really healthy food and supplements, and it was really intense.
Yeah, it was awful.
I'll let Andrew share his story, but he's just a phenomenal person, and I'm grateful that you're here today to share.
Thank you, Mary Ann, and thanks everybody for being here. So it wasn't very long ago that not only would I not have been invited to speak at things like this, but I wouldn't have been I wouldn't have had any interest in it, and I wouldn't have been allowed in anyway. My life today doesn't resemble the way things were 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, or even 5 years ago, really. So just to give you a brief, my name's Andrew Thomas. I'm the youngest of four. I'm a college graduate. I am today like a reliable employee. I like books a lot. I like to write. I like to watch sports. Go Warriors. Tough year. And I'm also an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I don't think that I knew what that meant for a long time. I thought that to be one of those, to be an alcoholic or an addict, there were certain criteria for that. You had to be a certain age. You had to be a certain. There was some things that you had to do. There were certain drugs that you had to do, or certain drug, you know, whatever. And since the outside of my life looked normal, you know, my parents are still married, my family's great, I went to college, I got into a good school, I had girlfriends, I had places to live, I had jobs, I thought that all of those things, disqualified me from having a problem. I thought that, like, I partied, but, like, so does everybody, so... I didn't know what was coming for me. And by the time I did, it was really late. As Mary Ann mentioned so I was on Suboxone for a long time. And the way that you get on that is you do, too many opiates, for too long of a period of time. I'm very much a child of the, like, I remember when OxyContin was new, and you know, like almost everyone I know, when I went to high school, I started experimenting with drugs and alcohol, and it was super fun. I started smoking pot, and I remember listening to, I don't know if anyone knows Radiohead, but I got stoned, and I listened to this Radiohead album, and I was like, whoa. And I had, like, a quintessential, you know, pot experience with it. I started drinking and it was fun, and I could, you know, talk to girls at parties and do silly stuff, and it seemed innocent enough. And then I took some Vicodin, and that was fun. And then I took some Percocet, and that was fun. And then, like, I just kind of incrementally went up the ladder the way that you do. And then Oxycontin came around, and it's much stronger than when I was in high school. It didn't seem like that big of a jump to go from taking a Vicodin and then taking a Percocet to taking an Oxycontin. They look the same. They're made of the same stuff. I didn't think it was that big of a jump. If I had known it was that big of a jump, I probably would have done it anyway. But anyway, like, it was a big jump, and that kind of, you know, my experience with that, you know, really drove the next 10 years of my, well, honestly, it probably still drives it. But I was under that for a very long time. You know, I think that, so things got really bad, right? I went from Oxycontin, and then that didn't work anymore. So I went to heroin, and you just, like, you keep going. And I didn't keep going because I was a bad person, and I didn't keep going because, like, I didn't give a shit about the world. I maybe thought those things, but in retrospect, like, I don't think that's why I kept going. I think I kept going because I'm just wired a little bit differently than most people. And when I take something that makes me feel good, I want more of it, period. And it doesn't really matter what the cost of that is. And so, like, like, one thing that I think it would have been helpful to know, again, it might not have changed anything, but it might have kind of hastened the end quicker, is... or, like, a problem for me was that, you know, in order to, like, I was a person who did drugs a lot, and in order to, like, maintain that as a lifestyle, you have to do things. I did things that I normally wouldn't have done. I lied to people that I really love. I stole from people that I really love. I was totally unreliable, although I was raised to be, like, a hard worker with a good ethic. I was totally flaky. I was scared all the time. I would run. I would yell. I would do all these things that that were not part of who I thought I was. And it's easy to draw the conclusion when you're doing those kinds of things that, like, I must be a bad person. Like, maybe I was just wrong. And it's now my understanding that that's not the case, that I was... You know, that while I'm accountable for all the stuff that I did, it was probably more accurate to describe me as a sick person than a bad one. But I didn't know that at the time. And again, like, not sure that it would have stopped me, but it would have. It was a relief to find that out when I found that out. So, let's get to how I found that out. Things got really bad. They got worse than I thought they could. I always thought that there would be something that would happen to me that would make me snap out of it, that I would get arrested, or that a girl would leave me, or that I would go to the hospital, and that some event would happen that would compel me to be like, you know what, I've had enough. This is now too much. I'm not going to do that anymore. And the reason I thought that is because that's the way it works for regular people. Like, if every time, you know, a regular person drank, they, you know, crashed their car, they would either, you know, they would be like, oh man, this is a problem, I should probably stop drinking. The people I run with, like, our conclusion to that is usually to stop driving. We're like, oh, I just won't drive anymore. And that way, so like, I drew these conclusions. I kept thinking that something was going to happen, like some outward event would happen, just like it did in the rest of my life. And I think that's an important point too, where this is, you know, my relationship with drugs and alcohol is the only thing in my life that works like that. If every time I played, you know, football, I ended up in the hospital, sooner or later I would be like, I probably shouldn't play football anymore. If every time I, you know, walked across the street, I got hit by a car, I would find a different street to walk across, or like I can think in those cause and effect and consequence in other areas of my life. I just either can't or don't in the way that it relates to drugs and alcohol. So what happened for me is, my story of recovery. So I haven't drank or used illegal drugs in a number of years now. It's amazing to me that I can say that. I never thought that that would be possible. And I think one of the reasons I never thought that would be possible is, I just thought I would never be able to, but also I didn't think I would ever want to. I think that there was a lot of times when I tried to kind of straighten things out, like after getting arrested or after going to the hospital, where I was like, I just want things to cool down a little bit. I just need to get my ducks in a row and get a new job and get some money and get a girlfriend. And then after that, once I have like things to live for again, once I have all the stuff that everyone else has that seems to be worth it, then I'll be fine. And it never, it never happened that way. But I think like one thing that I didn't think that I would ever not want to, and like I don't anymore. And that it's really hard to explain how big of a deal that is to people who don't know it. I mean, I was trying to think on in the 4 minutes of preparation I did for this. I was trying to think of a good corollary for a person who doesn't suffer from addiction or whatever, and it would be like if you just hated eating and you were like, I hate food. It's so stupid that I have to eat. And someone told you like, you can actually not eat it. Like, that's how unbelievable it is that I don't do the things that I used to do. There was a time when I was like, it's great that you all have these promises, and I believe that other people have gotten through this. There's just no way I'm going to. So how did I do it? Right. There's a couple things that I think are, important. I think there's lessons that like other people can learn from what I went through. And like one that I want to make real clear is like one of the ways that I learned is through failure, like a lot of failure. I tried to do this a bunch of times. I first went to rehab in 2010. And at that point I was like, I'm done. Like, I've had too much. This is too much. I had so much that I went back in 2015, and I don't think I finally. It was incremental change, and like I didn't. It was incremental change, and I had to fail a lot, and that's a tough. It's a tough thing to have to do, because my drug and alcohol use isn't incremental. So if I haven't used for a year and I start using again, it doesn't take any time to ramp up. So it feels like total failure, because it's like, oh, this is just like it was, maybe even worse. So failure was a big part of my experience. And I think it's important, or it was important for me to learn that, like, for me, that's just part of it. I know other people who went to rehab or walked into a 12-step meeting or one day said I'm done and who have never picked up again, and like, I hats off to them. That's awesome. It certainly can happen. It just didn't for me. So like my experience since 2010, since going to rehab for the first time, has been, really like coming to terms with the, maybe the gravity of my problem, or like the thing, the size of what I was up against, and knowing that for me, like, I couldn't afford to, I eventually reached a conclusion, I think, that like, I couldn't afford to be particular about like what kinds of help I got and what kind I didn't. So there was a point when I was like, okay, rehab, like, I need to do that. 12-step programs, I need to do that. Therapy, I need to do that. Like, eating better, need to do that. Suboxone, sure. Like, anything, like, I eventually, over the course of years, got ground down to a point, through suffering, really, and failure, where it was like, okay, this needs to change, and since this is a big problem, like, I need to be prepared to throw everything at it that I can. you know, like what was also confusing about that to me is that there are things that didn't work for me at certain times that did later. So like I first got sent to an AA meeting, for example, when I was in college. I got in a fight with a kid on the football team, and I went to a D1 school, so he was real big, and I was super drunk, and I was like, let's do it. And I got in a fight, stupidly. And so anyway, it was, I had a drinking problem, right? Like everyone else who went to that school knew that except for me. So I got sent to an AA meeting, and it was cool. Like I thought there was something, you know, on paper, nothing about it appealed to me. But when I got there, like the people seemed pretty cool, and there was some, there was clearly some like success and some hope there, and I thought that was cool. And I went for a week, and then I drank again, and I never went back. And I was like, great, good for you guys. You know, later in my life, those same meetings, because they're the same everywhere, would prove to be like hugely pivotal, and still are like hugely important to what I have going on. And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, for you, your kids, or whoever, like, just because something doesn't work once doesn't mean it won't later. Suboxone's another good example for that. I started taking Suboxone in, like, 2008, maybe. And it probably helped, you know, keep me alive, I guess, and which is important. And you know, maybe in the same way with AA, like I knew there was something there maybe. And I don't know if it was because I wasn't ready for it or it just wasn't the time. Like I did it for a while, said it's not for me, and, you know, failed maybe, you could say. didn't work for me then. Eventually, when I got back on it, it was like hugely pivotal in me getting to where I got. and like I can't really explain that in broad strokes terms. I just know that, like, you know, I'm not the best person to ask about like when help is going to help for me or when it's going to be the right kind of help. And just because I tried something once and it didn't work doesn't mean it won't later. You know, with, and so like, I think as a community, or like, if I look back, there's a whole personal side to it, right? Which is, you know, I had to get to a point where I was willing to do things that I didn't want to do to get what I wanted. I think regular people call that being an adult. but I, you know, I had to get to a point where I was like, I don't really want to go to therapy. I don't really want to go to meetings. I don't really want to be on Suboxone. I don't really want to do this stuff. But, like, I don't want to live the way that I have been living. So I need to be prepared to do some stuff I don't want to do. And so for me, like, it was very important to have resources available. You know, rehab was big for me, even though, like, it wasn't the last time I used and drank. Like, that was big for me. There was things I learned there that I didn't even know I learned until years later when I was confronted with something and I was like, oh, wait, that's what Dave said was going to – this is it. This is that moment he was talking about. And you know, the same way with Suboxone, like I had to, I think that it's important to like, you know, be able to kind of spread the message that like, there's a way out, you know, and like there are resources available, which I'm sure other people are going to talk about. So that was important to me. You know, I think another thing that, you know, one of the reasons this is so confusing, I think, to a lot of people is that, you know, like for a lot of people, and I think this is an important thing to kind of like keep in the open in general too, where, you know, for a lot of people, like drugs and alcohol are fun, you know, like I know people who drink and use sometimes and like it enhances the quality of their life. There's probably people in this room who will like go home and have a glass of wine or two and watch Jeopardy and like, it'll be great. I'm like, good for you. so like, I was in the DARE program where everyone was like, you know, which is essentially a different way of saying just say no. And I think it's important, at least for me to realize that like that didn't work then. And that's also like not my message. My message to kids is like, don't do what I did. Because that's what someone told me when I was young. And I was like, great. This is the whole like do as I say, not as I do. It doesn't work. I'm going to find out on my own. And like, but what I didn't know that I think would have been helpful to know is that even though, like when I drink or use, and someone next to me drinks or uses, like we have totally different experiences with it. Totally different. They look similar. And sometimes it looks like I just like, you know, drank a little too much the way regular people can go. But like, I am now convinced that I am like flat out wired differently. I think there's science to back that. And I'm, you know, and I honestly, like, I think that I was like that from, I don't think I did something to myself to get that way. I think I was like that when I was born. I'm just wired differently. And so it was tough to see people drinking and using drugs with impunity, you know, having fun with it the way that I used to. and then being like the only kid who couldn't. So that's like a tough hurdle to get across for like really good reasons. You know, you don't want to miss out. You don't want to like not have this thing that everyone else has But like I said at the beginning, you know, like I think that, you know, in retrospect, like one of the reasons that 12-step meetings, for example, have been so helpful to me, because those are people who like understand where I'm coming from in a way that other people don't. Where like I knew after being exposed to it that like there was a place I could go where I didn't have to explain all these things to people. They just got it. And like it's tough to you know, it's tough to it's hard to understand without ever having been there. And it's hard, and like to be honest also, it's hard to accept help. At the beginning, at least, I'm like way past that now. But at the beginning, it was really hard to accept help from someone who hadn't been there, because I did the like teenage, I mean, I was 25, but I still did the teenage thing where I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, you have to have been there and been through what I've been through to understand this. And, you know, luckily there is, you know, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that available. It's getting younger. And it's, you know, it's not that bad. So like one of the things, I guess, that I try to do today is just like be, you know, I guess in this sense, a public example of like, it was really bad and it's not anymore. And like it, you know, in some ways it's as simple as that, is that like, it was really, really bad. It was really, really hard. And I failed a lot. But like, because I had, you know, more than one chance, because I had tons of resources, because I had medical help, because I had psychological help, because I had a support group of people who were like me, because I had, you know, the opportunity to fail and come back. Like, because of all those things, I was able to get out from under something that had like totally ruled my life for, you know, 15 years in a row, and now it doesn't. And like, it's hard to overstate like how big of a deal that is for me and how important that was. Anyway, I'm glad that everyone's here. I'm glad that the conversation is, you know, getting more open, because I think that's important. I'm glad the conversation is getting more honest, because that's important. And I'm glad to be some small part of like getting the message out that like, this is a problem. We can look at it or not look at it, but like, it's a problem and it's going to remain one probably no matter what we do. But like, but that doesn't mean we can't help, right? There does not have to be 100% success for us to help. Like, we just have to make it a little better and then a little better and a little better. So anyway, glad to be a small part of that. And thanks for coming.
I'm Andrea McCullough. I work at Adventist Health Howard Memorial, and I have an interest in substance use and alcohol use. So I'm happy to talk later about, you know, specific medical treatments that we have or other doctors have or any other questions you might have. But when I was thinking about teenagers and substance use, I kind of was thinking of, where is it that it starts? you know, or what are some of the contributing factors or some of the paths that people walk down that lead them there? And how does that knowledge help us possibly for other people to try to keep other people from walking that path? And so in terms of risk factors, there's some risk factors that you can work on, right? And there's some risk factors that are fixed. Andrew was talking about, you know, is there a genetic predisposition? Well, there isn't a whole lot you can do for that other than a gene transplant. So some things we probably can't fix very well, but there might be other things that we can get in on the ground floor and work on ahead of time. In terms of risk factors, you know, knowing that a kid without any risk factors at all can get turned on to drugs or alcohol and end up with a substance use problem is really important to know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But the first category that I think about in terms of especially for, well, before I get to teenagers, I think in general, all of us, not just teenagers or preteens, but all of us have a hole, you know? You could call it a spiritual hole, or, you know, the serotonin and the dopamine craving that your brain has, or you can call it whatever you want, but we all have this hole that we want to fill with something. And so I think that's a really big part for any of us that leads to substance use. In teenagers specifically, you know, you think about boredom, you think about thrill seeking, you think about low self-esteem, and those are things that are common to almost anybody of a certain age. And drugs and alcohol are a super, super, super great way to fill that need. So, you know, what do you do with that information? I mean, it sounds dorky, but I do think that, you know, getting to kids at an early age and finding something else that floats their boat, something else that keeps them, you know, excited to get up in the morning is a really great way to start. Be that sports, be that 4-H, be that, you know, we want to do really well in school, whatever that is. I think it's, you know, it can be helpful for obvious reasons, like it organizes your schedule. It exposes you to kids that are less likely to use. Raises your self-esteem. Now, saying that, you know, I want you to remember that in some ways, sports can be a gateway drug, because the second big path to, especially for pain pill abuse, is getting a legitimate pain prescription from a doctor. And that happens to grown-ups and that happens to kids alike. You know, we all know people, or I know people, who, you know, fell off a horse, had a femur injury playing football, you know, had a totally legitimate reason to get a pain pill prescription, and then you kind of run out of the pills, especially, you know, in the last decade. Doctors have been really bad about this. You run out of the prescription, you still have a little bit of pain. We in this community have zero tolerance for pain. You know, there's no legitimate excuse to ever have to suffer any kind of pain. So you get a refill, and then, you know, that when that runs out, you still have the pain, and next thing you know, it's a pain pill problem and not a pain problem. So what do we do about that? Well, you know, of course, doctors are more conscious of this now. We are trying to limit how much pain pills we give somebody for a surgery. You know, doctors will give you 20 pills, and after that, you're going to tough it out. I do think that the toughing it out part of it is a big sea change that we have to do in this country in terms of, you know, understanding that a certain amount of pain is acceptable in life. And I think that using alternatives for pain, of course, like ibuprofen and blah, 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 you know, cognitive changes, blah, blah, blah. Another problem for teenagers specifically is it's very, very easy to access pain pills and alcohol. 60% of teenagers who use pain pill prescriptions get them for free from their friends or family. So that's, you know, like falling off a log. That's very hard to confront. That's very hard to block. Some of the time, it's intentional. I have a number of patients in recovery who were first introduced to pain pills by their dad. I hate to call out dads, but in this case, it was always dads. You know, what do you do with that? You know, a parental figure, somebody that you respect, kind of exposing you to this, it's very, very hard to say no. I mean, that's hard to answer. I do think that if as a parent, for example, you know that your significant other has a substance use issue, talking to your kid from a young age, like if dad ever does offer you pain pills, I want you to say, I love you, dad, I respect you, but the answer is no, and if you continue to ask me, I'm going to call mom, or whatever, you know, I think, but presenting it honestly from a young age, I think is probably not going to hurt and could possibly help. I was just talking to one of my patients today, whose dad turned around to drugs, and I said, you know, what would you say? Could anything have come in between you and your dad in terms of starting pills? And she said, well, my aunt tried. You know, she had custody of me. She tried to keep me. And my grandmother wanted me to go with my dad because my dad was my biological. And she, you know, preferred the sons in her family. And she wanted him to have custody of me. And so she went with him. And she had been on the swim team. She was a cheerleader. She wanted to go to the Olympics, you know. And she's in a very, very, very different place right now. And so, I mean, it's hindsight's 20/20. But those are just things to think about. Some of the time when you get onto drugs or alcohol from your, especially drugs from friends or family that are on them, it's an accident. So there was a study that suggested that you're twice as likely to end up in the emergency room with an overdose if anyone in your house has a pain pill prescription. So I as a doctor, I'm not good enough about reminding people that if you're on pain meds, you have to lock them up if there's any possibility that somebody can get into them. So for that, Buffy and I brought lock bags so that they're out here free for anybody to take. I would especially recommend them for pain pills and sleeping pills like Valium or Xanax or anything like that. And we can show you how to use them afterwards. And then the final path that I wanted to talk about is neglect. We're very, very busy in this culture, and we don't, you know, some of our parents are working two or three jobs at a time. You're not home very much. That's another, you know, big risk factor for drug and alcohol abuse. So I do think that, again, it's dorky, but having family time, like, set aside, like, every Sunday night we're going to have dinner together as a family, I feel like we're really getting away from that as a culture, and I think that it can be very, very helpful for teenagers to at least have some voice of reason kind of always in the background. There's a study that suggested that kids whose parents talk to them regularly about drugs and alcohol are 50% less likely to end up using drugs and alcohol. So, you know, it's not going to work all the time, but it's definitely something worth trying. Final, you know, other risk factors, family history of drug or alcohol use, mental health problems in kids, history of sexual abuse or other abuse, and problems with impulse control or aggression as a kid. And so, you know, identifying potential kids with these problems at a young age and trying to get them on the right path and have them in counseling or have them, you know, on sports teams or whatever, I think are all things for us to think about to try to decrease the epidemic. And again, if anybody wants to talk about specific medical stuff with addiction afterwards, I'm happy to talk about that. I'm Buffy Wright Barassa. Can you hear me? I'm a program specialist too for Mendocino County HHSA Public Health Community Wellness. Long. I work in the prevention unit and prevention from what, right? So I'm actually working under some grants for the opioid epidemic. We received grant funding from the state and DHCS. For our coalition, SafeRx Mendocino. Some of you have heard of us, some of you work with me. And that meeting happens every month. This month it'll be this Wednesday, 8:30, Public Health. Yes, I'm putting in a plug. Why? Because we are a community of our members in this county. And we need people from schools and law enforcement and the pharmacies. Especially the pharmacies, I'd like to say that as well. So if you know anyone from pharmacies, let them know, you know, we need to talk. And there's a reason, right? And the reasons that we need to talk is because we're trying to attack this opioid epidemic in our county in all kinds of aspects. We're trying to manage and treat and, you know, and save people's lives and prevent it from happening. And so that's a huge job, and I can't do it by myself, and neither could either any of us up here. So we need community support in this. And So in my piece, I also work under another grant. It's called Partnership for Success. And that grant, it targets youth in our county from 12 to 25. And so for the first couple years, I was showing up in outlying schools, and we contracted with Mendocino Community Youth Project, who also does this work, and Orly can talk about it more on her end, because she's given us some great data as well. I show up to like assemblies out in Potter Valley, out in Point Arena, up in Covelo, and I've used the Operation Prevention, the DEA's website, and done some teaching at New Beginnings as well. Those kids are fun. They're like water. You can't hold their attention for long. But the difference in what I do is I don't just come out and I don't just talk about the drugs. I talk about, like, what are you doing? How are you making choices? You know, because I think you have to back it up. Right. And when you do that and you start talking about, OK, so what are you doing after school? Oh, I'm going to go home and smoke some pot. Cool. Do you think you can wait 15 minutes? You know, it's not, hey, don't do that. And I know that would be like my first response. I have children. Trust me, I have plenty of times. I can't believe that. No way. Don't do that. But the truth is I just want them to wait so that they start thinking, so that they can start making better choices. And this last year, I was fortunate enough to join Rotary. And Rotary is, our Willits Rotary is a very, it's just a beautiful thing. And I'm very new to it. And then I got roped into and voluntold that, hey, maybe we can do Interact. And so Willits High School opened up the doors to me and allowed me to come in there. And we started Interact, and we officially have a club, and I'm very excited. And so the Interact Club will be working to come up with two projects, and hopefully we get some youth soon to be of service at our Crab Fest. The other club that is happening at Willits High School is the Native American Club. I'm very passionate about it. So back in September, we had a take-back event at the Willits High School outside during a football game. And my thing and Oralee's thing was, hey, how do we support them? Because there's already protective factors in the school. So we talked about risk factors, but there's also protective factors, and they're already here. It's a matter of how are we supporting those things that are happening. I'm a working mom, and so when I get home, you know, the kids have already been there for a while, but what happened while I wasn't there, right? So there's people in place, because I have a big family, who's checking out, and I've got people checking in with me, so that, and then we have conversations, you know, and I take that time, regardless of how late I was out the night before, or that night, you know, working, or doing my other job, right? Because I'm on tribal council here for Sherwood Valley. I always make that time to have the conversation. So what's going on? What, you know, and I've got a lot of kids, so this could take a while. But, you know, and it's important. But back to Willits High School, I'm really impressed with them because they really do support the clubs that are there in the school. They have an amazing athletic program as well. I met the Peace Club, and there's some other clubs. I was just impressed. There was two clubs. There was a Christian club and a non-secular, I believe. I don't know as much, but they shared a table together. I was like, wow, why can't we do that, right? So, you know, it's a good thing. Our community really does have the protective factors in place. It's a matter of us stepping up and, you know, supporting these things and taking our time out of our busy days to continue working with one another. I find it really important also to be honest and open with the youth that I work with. And have found myself getting information that I wouldn't have normally gotten. So, like, I know that there's pills on the streets of Mendocino County, all over the place. These kids are taking their Xanax. They're not really Xanax. They have fentanyl in them. And I also, unfortunately, know that we're losing people as well. And that's the somber part. And it's hard for me because I also have lost people because of the opioid epidemic. My brother and my youngest son's father passed away from an overdose. And then the other one was complications with that drug and other drugs. And that's usually what's happening also, is it's not just one drug, it's several. And it's unfortunate. And unfortunately, you know, when I started 3 years ago,
We didn't have any youth who had passed away from an overdose. And then the following year, we had two youth. And in this last year, we've had several youths from Covelo over onto the South Coast. And here in Willits, we've had some people. And when I say youth, I mean 25 and under. You know, and that breaks my heart. So I'm thinking, so what do we do? You know, and how do we have these conversations with one another? Like, I need to have the connection with law enforcement. I have a really good connection with the sheriff's department, and I'm grateful for that. We've worked really hard together. They've got their policies and procedures in place to carry Narcan, and then we applied for Narcan. It was a free distribution program, and we supplied them with Narcan. At this point, we're kind of like in a standstill. We got so much free Narcan. What are we going to do now? How do we get more Narcan? You know, how do we get Narcan in places where you wouldn't think of having Narcan? Like, you have an EpiPen at the school. Do you have Narcan? And do you have, you know, policy in place for that? And I know that's like, holy cow, really? Are we talking that serious? Yes. Yeah. In Fort Bragg, I talked to city council member Bernie over there. He said they know there's someone with a pill press, but they can't find him. Mm-hmm. You know, and that are, you know, and our youth, that's our youth. So let's save them, right? Let's save them so that they have a chance to do something, you know, in the future and be great. Right? We don't know what someone's future is going to be. And, you know, and the more that we start talking about this, then it lowers that stigma. Oh, that's just a junkie. Oh, yeah, of course that kid has problems. They come from the reservation, or their parents were alcoholics. They were addicts too. They come out of the system. We need to stop thinking in those terms and start thinking about, you know, these are our people of our community, you know, and how do we lift them up and how do we support them in their journey? And I'm obviously very passionate about these types of things. So the other thing that I want to touch on, I don't know how much time I have now, but I want to, just a couple more minutes. So I'm trying to get these bags out and I'm trying to get out Narcan, and we're doing presentations, health fairs, however you need us to work. We're trying to be there for our community. We are having a Narcan training at Consolidated Tribal Health. I brought flyers and put them on the table over there. CRIB, which is California Indian Rural Health Board, will be there doing the training, and they promised me more Narcan. So, and the other thing that that I'm passionate about and I do is I make the connections between the tribes. So you have a tribe here. I know that our connections with the rest of the community are minimal, very minimal. I know with the rest of the tribes, it's the same thing. And so part of my work is building that bridge between the county and McAvin, MCYP, whoever, the hospitals, however we need to do that, the school, so that we can start working together, because this is a WE program.
Tell them
right?
What McAvin is.
McAvin is Mendocino County AIDS and Viral Hepatitis Network, which actually dropped the hepatitis piece, and their flyer is actually over there as well. They are doing the needle exchange. They're going around and picking up needles all over the place. I know that they pick them up off of our reservation here in Willits off our playground. Isn't that awesome? And they also do other services like testing for hepatitis and... I can't tell you everything, but it's over there. Anyways, I really appreciate you all coming and listening. This is near and dear to my heart and obviously to yours. Thank you.
My name's Aura Lee. I work for the Mendocino County Youth Project. I passed my 10-year mark there this December, which... is significant. I've gotten to really witness this community evolve, and I feel like there's more and more coalescing. There's more and more people who are, as Andrew has said, wanting to have honest conversation, wanting to come together and recognize that, unfortunately, crisis brings us to a place where maybe we're a little more willing to look at what really is hard to look at, hard to address. Sure. And I think in a lot of ways my job is a prevention early intervention specialist in this community, working with 12 to 18 year olds in all the junior highs and high schools here. I'm now program manager for here and for North County in general. And what I see is that young people are often underestimated for what they truly understand as far as what stress is going on, the bigger challenges in the world at large. I did, and I'm not trying to get political on you guys, I'm going to just say this as a fact, that I had more suicide assessments right after our most recent president was elected, specifically because of the stress that was going on a political level. So I think that they're one of the main differences between the younger generations and the generation that I'm seeing in front of me is that when we were younger, we did not have exposure and as easy access to the stresses of the world. And kids are really, really tracking that stuff way, way more than we even realize. And honestly, they're kind of the raw form of it. So we want to like look at teenagers and be like, what are you doing wrong? And I'm like, no, they're the raw expression of the symptoms of our culture. So if they're showing up with drug addiction and not being able to deal with their feelings, cope with stress, manage life, time management, that's because we're, as a community, lacking in that way. And that's not to point the finger at anybody and to take blame. I think there's a lot of the messages I've heard up here are about let's not shame ourselves, but let's take accountability. So how can we do that? How can we take responsibility for a culture which has not shown us how to grieve, has not shown us how to stress manage, has not shown us really genuine skills? And so the most important thing that I've learned through my journey around working with young people is that as you had so beautifully spoken, want to have some place to belong, want to have something that they're good at. And those are actually the building blocks for self-esteem. Yeah. Being good at something, being involved somewhere, being accountable, being shown how to be resilient, which is really where I'm going to end my conversation as I get closer to that moment, is how important it is to model and genuinely bounce back and show young people that, hey, just because you make mistakes, just because you falter over and over and over again, I still am going to be able to have the moment where I look at you beyond your behaviors. So my mom failed in a lot of ways to show up for me and was an extreme addict and is barely hanging on for her very last probably little while right now. But I think the most beautiful thing she did for me, despite all of her insanity, was show up with shameless accountability. She, in the moments where I was making the biggest mistakes and I was getting subpoenaed to court and I was getting arrested, she showed up and was like, what are you thinking? Like, what other options could you have? And, you know, like, let's look at this thing and talk about it, you know? And so for me, the thing about nagging and yelling and criticizing and that doesn't work. Like, do any of you, when you are actually making change in your life, like, is it work when your husband's like, you need to whatever, fill in the blank, right? It's like, no, like, right? Like, no, right? So, like, I think, like, if we can, I think one of the reasons why kids feel so safe for me and why I've become a person that many administrators and teachers call in this community to talk to the more difficult young people in our community, more difficult, the kids who are having a hard time expressing themselves, is because I show up and I look at, like, I respect you as much as I respect, it doesn't matter how old you are, or where you come from, or I'm just like, hey, you're your own expert. You know your own life better. And I'm not going to come here, even as a counselor, it's a lot easier for me. As a parent, I just imagine, like, I imagine there's just moments where you're like, yeah, I can't do it. But like, but as a counselor, I love this role. It's great. You go home afterwards and then I don't have to suffer the consequences of your choices. So I recognize that. But still in this way, as much as one can do that in a parent capacity or in a community member capacity, is how can I have open, honest dialogue with you about what that is? Another piece that I really want to pitch is that there are awesome 10-minute videos on YouTube that tell you all about the development of the teen brain and how it isn't until 25. I know they look like adults, but they're really kind of like little people in big bodies. And so if we can remember that, I think actually some of the biggest boys that I know that look like men, all of a sudden you're like, yeah, he's still 15 years old. Like, he might look like a man, but like, there's a 15-year-old brain, maybe a 12-year-old in trauma, maybe he's 8 years old, like, it, right? It's like, yeah, the layers and layers. So I think as parents and community members, their prefrontal cortex is not developed. So we have to act in a loving way as that prefrontal cortex as much as possible, and then provide opportunities for them to make mistakes, figure it out on themselves, and let and support them in how to think, rather than punishing and making them afraid of doing things. Is help me think it out, Mom, so that when I get out there on my own, that I know how to think through my problems. I know how to come up with solutions. I have strategies. And there's these, your brain is really vulnerable and under special susceptibility when you're under 25. And so it's really important to be introducing, one, you're extra vulnerable to addiction, but you're also extra available for skill development and all these kinds of things. So I've heard it time and time again. I know for myself, I didn't quit drugs. I chose something else. So for me, that were the most important things in my own sobriety, and what I've witnessed with other people is that if I want a dopamine rush, now I don't need to do these drug addictive behaviors. I can go into nature. I can ride on my bike. I can, and figuring out how do I create that. So yes, it's important to do the counseling and the therapy and all those things. But if I just stay there and I just stay in this treatment thing, then I'm never going to come up with new ways of identifying myself. Because when somebody told me just quit smoking weed when I was a kid, I'm like, that means I'm quitting weed. I'm quitting my money income because I was selling. I'm quitting all of my social circle. It's like, yeah. We have to understand what we're asking when we say those things. For me, having the positive attitude of resilience and figuring out how can I keep a positive attitude is probably the most important thing that I've figured out in my life, is that I have to take diligent self-care. And I see some people in the audience tonight who your job is to take care of people. And so how do we find that balance? If we're going to be the ones who caretake, then how do I really unapologetically take care of myself as well? I think we're all too good at when the people who care and show up and want to give energy but maybe aren't as good as doing that for yourself. So my encouragement is take loving and fearless care of yourselves. I have a poetic version of resilience on the table over there, and I have a kind of ways to support resilience in youth that's more of like, these are the sound bites that I've kind of just said about my insights of my work with young people. Both of those are on that table. There's a lot of brochures and information about our local therapy and services. We're providing prevention groups and classroom presentations, and we run a free clothes closet. I have a brochure over there where people can receive free clothes. I accept donations and accept appointments. So I'll just be standing over there. I'm kind of known in my program and by many of my colleagues as the resource queen of our county. So I get phone calls from everywhere about what's available, and I am really one phone call or email away from pretty much any service that's available in this community. I think of myself as an aunt of, in fact, I'm all of your mothers as well. I'm your aunties, even if you're older or younger, it doesn't matter. So I'm available. I have business cards there. I'm happy to answer any questions. If not in this community forum, at any point, you're welcome to reach out, and I'm very available to direct you in the right way if I don't have the answer. So thank you for your guys' time and your interest in showing up to listen to a challenging topic.
Further information on Avenues to Wellness is available at avenuestowellness.org, 707-456-9676. SafeRxMendocino.com is a website that has a lot of information and contacts, and SafeRx's phone number is 707-472-2610. The Mendocino County Behavioral Health and Recovery Services may be reached at 707-472-2300. The Mendocino County Youth Project has a website, mcyp.org, and a phone number, 707-463-4915. Naloxone is a nasal spray that can save a life in the case of an overdose of opioids, and is available to organizations from McCavin at 707 462 1932. If someone is overdosing on opioids, call 911.
That's all for this month's edition of Youth Speaks Out. Laneville Healthy Start Coalition's Drug-Free Communities Project is proud to support this month's Youth Speaks Out. Our Environmental Prevention Strategies in the Community, also known as EPIC, is a project funded by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Through our organization and coalition, we are working towards reducing youth substance abuse through a variety of strategies in the Laneville community. If you are interested in learning more about our efforts, please contact Laneville Healthy Start at 707-984-8089 or email jayma@laneville.org. jayma@laytonville.org.
Youth Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490, or through the website www.youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of a show, and listen to many hours of previous programs and streaming audio. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this radio station. They are the views of those who express them. Youth Speaks Out is free to rebroadcast upon notification. Our shows are posted monthly at our website, youthspeaksout.net. You can find our podcast link there or on iTunes. Thanks for listening.